Henry Kissinger is the only unindicted member of the old Watergate gang, and in that capacity was repeatedly found to have deceived Congress on very high and grave matters.
War on terrorism, particularly all the money that's going towards there, is going to affect women and women of color.
I see nothing connecting the war on Iraq with what looks to be an al-Qaeda attack on the Israeli passenger plane and hotel.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, December 2nd, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The war on terrorism took a nosedive today. At least that's the collective opinion of a number of anti-war advocates who view the appointment of former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger to head the investigation into 9-1-1 as nothing short of a disaster. Rita Lazar, sister of Abe Zalmanowicz, is one of the many victims of the September 11th attack on the World Trade Center and a member of September 11th Families for a Peaceful Tomorrow, a group of family members of the September 11th attacks who oppose war with Iraq.
I'm afraid that if Henry Kissinger has a choice between the security of the Bush administration or the truth, he will opt for the former. That means that I will not find out why my brother is dead. I'm speaking, I think, for many of us who lost relatives. I mean, Henry Kissinger, ever since I heard that he had been named, I am walking around livid with my head spinning. For Bush to have appointed him is cynical beyond anybody's ability to understand.
Christopher Hitchens is a columnist and author of The Trial of Henry Kissinger. We spoke with him and filmmaker Eugene Jarecki, who used to work at the World Trade Center and lost friends and families in the attack. His goal is to get the Kissinger appointment overturned.
So I think that anybody who cares about justice in the world and plain old human decency had to have been deeply saddened by George Bush's choice to answer the plea of the families of victims of 9/11 who desperately need understanding, closure, and information about what happened on that day. George Bush's choice to answer that plea with so cynical and smug, I felt, an answer as placing Dr. Kissinger
now, what is
in that
this
job.
Name that's on here with
it was saddening. It meant that he was willing to put a man who's devoted his career to secrecy in the most sensitive job in the land for answering real questions and opening up an understanding of what happened on that day.
Mm. We're also joined by Professor Christopher Hitchens. Professor Hitchens, you have studied Mr. Henry Kissinger extensively. Good idea or bad idea to have him head up this this investigation?
There are three reasons. There are four distinct reasons why it is an appalling idea and why it expresses terrible cynicism and contempt on the part of the president who didn't want an inquiry and who shows that he didn't by announcing the appointment of such a man on the eve of Thanksgiving in the hope, I suppose, of burying it a bit. The first reason is this. Henry Kissinger is the only unindicted member of the old Watergate gang, and in that capacity was repeatedly found to have deceived Congress on very high and grave matters. The best-known example, of course, was his lying to Congress about the secret war in Cambodia, the secret bombing and blitzing of Cambodia, which actually was one of the original articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon that, alas, were never used. Another notorious example would be, and a very relevant one, would be his withholding of crucial evidence from Senator Frank Church's committee of investigation in the Senate into skullduggery and intelligence failure in the intelligence community. In other words, both criminal and knavish and stupid activity, which led to the publication of a very important report. It was believed that everything had been shown to the committee. We now know that it was not, and we know who kept it from them. So that's the first reason, or two elements of the first reason. The second is that Mr. Kissinger is wanted in by the magistrates of several countries to answer.
Is he, in fact, an international war criminal?
Well, he hasn't been convicted or even indicted yet, but let's say that he's been summoned for questioning by the magistrates in Paris, in Santiago in Chile, and in Buenos Aires in Argentina, who are investigating his part in what can only be called, and this is the important bit, international terrorism. His role, for example, in Operation Condor, which was an international gangster organization of the extreme right supported by military dictatorships to whom he was friendly, which carried out bombings in Washington, D.C., among other places. Until September 11th, the worst atrocity on American soil was the car bomb in Washington, D.C. in 1976 in rush hour traffic, which killed a famous Chilean exile and his American companion. His friend and client, Augusto Pinochet, gave the order for that bombing, and it was the culmination of a series of kidnappings and bombings and other terrorist acts carried out by Operation Condor, a terrorist international with which we have every reason to think Henry Kissinger was complicit. So as an investigator of terrorism, shall we say, he's deeply compromised, and there are certain countries where he wouldn't dare go, because those summonses, that he's been refusing to answer them, are still extant. Served with a summons in Paris on Memorial Day last year, he beat the summons and fled town. It's still valid, however, if he goes back. So this is an international disgrace and humiliation for the United States to have someone who's effectively a wanted man. Third, there are a number of people who think, I'm not among them, that the intelligence failure was so gross before September 11th, it amounts practically to complicity. It's almost as if somebody wanted this to happen. I'm strongly of the opinion that's not true, but an appointment of a notorious cover-up artist to the investigation quite obviously is going to license paranoid speculations of various kinds. And then I'll mention one more thing, because we're in the run-up to a confrontation with Saddam Hussein at the moment. In the inquiries into intelligence skullduggery and malfeasance that have occurred before, which Henry Kissinger helped to derail or to keep in the dark, was his own role in betraying the Kurdish people of Iraq, in encouraging them to fight against Saddam Hussein with the help of his other client and friend, the Shah of Iraq, and then cutting them off in the middle of their struggle, abandoning them to Saddam Hussein's tender mercies without telling them that American support was going to be withdrawn. One of the most cruel and nasty actions in the recent American past. Now, here are the four headings I've just given you. I could have gone on much greater length,
mm-hmm.
but any one of them, it seems to me, is an absolute disqualification.
Well,
the guy should not be in charge of any commission. He should be in front of a Senate inquiry or an inquiry from an American district attorney for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and grave offenses against the U.S. Constitution.
And I'd like to get both of your responses. What about his connection to the Saudi Arabian royal family, his oil connections there? How do you see that as a factor in this whole scenario?
Well, we know that he has had a lot of contact with the Middle East and with the oil-rich elements of it. We don't know exactly his client list because Kissinger Associates doesn't publish a client list, and indeed it insists that all its clients sign confidentiality agreements. Mr. Kissinger has assured us that he wouldn't allow conflict of interest to arise, but that's not good enough. His private word is worth nothing anyway, or his public word. He's a proven liar. He should be forced to publish his client list and make it known what the potential conflicts of interest might be.
Well, if his client list were published, are either of you familiar enough with his past dealings to suspect that some names may be on there that would prove problematic?
I heard Dr. Kissinger yesterday on television make clear that he has no Saudi clients. He does not represent any Saudi clients. And the tricky bit for me is what is known is that what little is known, as Christopher correctly points out, Mr. Kissinger keeps his client list very secretive. What has been revealed about it over the years is that certainly there are firms in representation who do have links to Saudi Arabia in their own business practices. It may be that when Dr. Kissinger yesterday chose his words carefully and said, "I don't have any Saudi clients," he may have meant he didn't have specifically Saudi nationals as clients. That would be one thing. It would be interesting to know, maybe he'll answer that publicly, whether he has clients who do business in Saudi Arabia with the Saudi royal family or with or who have their principal base of operations.
What came to mind to me was that he doesn't have any now, which doesn't mean that he didn't have any in the past.
Or doesn't hope to have some in the future, one might add.
Precisely.
But I think that's actually the nice
thing. But the other thing is it involves taking his word for it, and there's absolutely no reason to do that. He's whenever he can be tested, as in the volumes of his memoirs, which now constitute three volumes, if you can check, as we now can with declassified documents, his assertions about very important matters, the role of his negotiations with China over Vietnam, with South Africa over Angola, with Indonesia over East Timor, at every point he's found to have published an absolute falsified record. It doesn't matter what you think morally of what he did. The fact remains that he's printed a falsified record based on misappropriated documents that he abstracted unlawfully from the State Department.
Actually, aside from the fact that he's been appointed to this to head up this commission, many people are wondering why he is not on trial for war crimes. But also, many are concerned that the administration is not investigating the whole Saudi Arabia oil connection with respect to this impending war against Iraq. Is that a concern on either of your parts, Eugene Jarecki or Christopher Hitchens?
I think whenever you see a hot spot in the world, and you get the sense that the news and those in power keep talking about all the cool spots in the world, you have to start wondering why they don't talk about the hot spots. And Saudi Arabia, which has clearly a central set of issues relating to U.S. concerns, the Saudis have clerics who clearly had very strong feelings about fatwas in the United States, the Saudi government, as we know. Saudi business leaders have been taking an enormous amount of money out of the U.S. stock market. I have this sort of a sense that the Saudi Arabia, as a sort of key supplier to the United States, is an extremely sensitive issue. There's almost a part of me that wonders what will happen after a war in Iraq with this Saudi royal family, who the United States views as a bit of a nuisance. And so in a way, it's not so clear to me that they don't want the investigation to go and make the Saudis look bad. I think we keep talking about errors in intelligence and errors on what happened on that day. I think what one really has to wonder about are what are the relationships that that have stood the test of time between U.S. policymakers, U.S. business leaders, and any corrupt regimes around the world. And certainly Saudi Arabia is a hot spot where a lot of activity has gone on, and it would not be in Dr. If Dr. Kissinger doesn't have a direct interest that he would be contravening, he surely has a friend or a business associate who in turn has a business associate. Unfortunately, those kind of business arrangements are like a hydra, you know, and it's not just as simple as, well, I don't have a stamp in my passport from that place. The world is a global village, and a lot of these things are very linked. And so, yeah, I'm troubled by the sort of silence as it relates to that part of the world.
Filmmaker Eugene Jarecki, the filmmaker of The Trial of Henry Kissinger. Also in that segment was Christopher Hitchens. A recent scandal about an aide to Canadian Prime Minister Chrétien, who was forced to resign after calling President Bush a moron, got linguist Mark Crispin Miller to thinking. He's the author of Bush Dyslexicon, Observations of a National Disorder. He says it's not right to call President Bush a moron.
So when that whole thing blew up, it became quite a scandal up there in Canada, and a bit less of a scandal down here. But it was timely, as far as I'm concerned, because I'm now convinced and have been trying to publicize the fact that our president is not a moron. He's not an imbecile.
I'm sure that a lot of people will be happy to hear that.
Well, maybe so, but actually my view is that we'd be better off if he were a moron. Now, I'm not denying that he has his intellectual limitations. He's not an educated person and doesn't have any intellectual curiosity. And he's not terribly good at really subtle reasoning. But a moron would be incapable of the kind of political calculation that Bush really does excel at. My view of him, and this is based on very close examination of his off-the-cuff remarks, you know, I've studied carefully what he has said mm-hmm. over the years. My view is that he's a sociopath, someone who's devoid of empathy, someone who has an exaggerated sense of his own entitlement, someone who really doesn't seem to mind inflicting pain on others. And the most interesting manifestation of this whole, I don't know what you'd call it, pathology, I suppose, mm-hmm. is that his famous grammatical and syntactical mistakes, the things that people like to laugh at, mm-hmm. Almost always tend to come when he's trying to sound compassionate or idealistic or altruistic.
For example?
Well, I know how hard it is for you to put food on your family. That's a famous one. He said that when he was campaigning in New Hampshire. He didn't say that. My argument is he didn't say that because he's too dumb to know that the expression is put food on the family table. It's typical, rather, in that he has a very hard time even pretending to care about the have-nots. Here's a more recent one.
Couldn't that just be considered a slip of the tongue?
Well, it would be a slip of the tongue if it weren't part of a pattern. The fact is that when he speaks about punishment or war, when he promises payback or revenge, when he talks about the death penalty, in other words, when he slips into the punitive key, he has no trouble with his syntax or his grammar. Now, if it were a matter of now and then making a mistake, sure, it'd be a slip of the tongue. But when you consistently make mistakes like that, when you're trying to sound like you care about the underprivileged, when you're trying to sound like you care about peace, when you're trying to sound like you care about education, when you're trying to sound like you believe in democracy, but you make no such mistakes when you're promising revenge and you're speaking of war and you're celebrating the death of your enemies, I think that's extremely significant.
Well, now, are your observations based on any sort of scientific or psychological expertise or knowledge?
Well, my expertise is the expertise of literary criticism. My PhD is in English, and I approached Bush's speech, as I would approach any text, just looking for patterns that might shed light on the mind behind the words. I don't pretend to have any kind of medical expertise, but I will say that the readers of the Bush Dyslexicon have included a lot of mental health professionals who have contacted me, scores of them actually, to share with me their views as to why and how exactly Bush does tend to do the thing I'm describing. In other words, the tendencies are there. Anyone who studies his extemporaneous remarks will see this. The question is, to what extent is it a result of some kind of, brain damage due to substance abuse?
Mm-hmm.
To what extent is it some other kind of psychological malfunction? The long and short of it is, when it comes to the political art of expressing sympathy with those unlike yourself, when it comes to the political art of being able to capture a mood of mourning or grief, this president can't do it. In the latest edition of the Bush Dyslexicon, I analyzed the way Bush has talked about 9/11, and it is very interesting because unlike Giuliani, say, or unlike Tony Blair, Bush could never deal verbally with the grief of the attacks. He would only bring up the sadness of the attacks as a way to get to the point about kicking ass. He would say, we're sad now, but we're crying now, but we're going to get revenge.
Mm-hmm. So, and you're saying that his inability to relate or to really grieve, therefore, puts him into the category of being a sociopath.
I'd say that a whole range of his tendencies, as expressed in his language, suggest a sociopathic type of temperament.
So there was no, throughout the entire September 11th observances, he not once identified with the grief and spoke
right.
of the grief in an articulate and manner that was not, where he was not misspeaking?
I would say that it was, when it came up, it was something that he would hasten to get over as fast as he could. He's never been accused of being a softy,
Mm-hmm.
This is a guy who...
Well, he has teared up.
He has teared up, yes. He teared up very famously on the 13th, 9/13, when he had just finished talking on the phone with Giuliani and Pataki. But that was, he was tearing up not out of sadness. He was talking about it being a terrible moment. This is someone who has said to reporters, this has been reported widely, that he believes himself to have been picked by God to fight the war on terrorism. At the moment that he teared up on 9/13, he was overwhelmed by the enormity of his historic mission. I think it was grandiosity that moved him to tears. I don't think it was grief. This is a guy, let's not forget, who actually cracked a joke about Carla Faye Tucker, who was kept on death row, and he kept her in suspense as to whether or not she was going to be pardoned. Someone whom many Christian fundamentalists had begged him to save from execution. And in being interviewed about it by Tucker Carlson during the campaign, he made a joke about her begging for life. "Please don't kill me," he said in a kind of, you know, imitation of a pathetic squeal. His jokes, by the way, I've got a whole chapter of them in the Bush Dyslexicon, his jokes all tend to be cruel. Some of them are downright sadistic.
Mark Crispin Miller, literary critic. Across the country, there is a groundswell against the war in Iraq. Seniors Against the War, Mothers in Solidarity of the Iraqi Children and Families have sprung up all over the U.S. High school and college students have walked out of classrooms. We spoke with Michael Zamalek, outreach coordinator for the National Network to End the War Against Iraq.
We're seeing a groundswell of activity that I think is unprecedented since the 60s. We're hearing from people in small towns and local communities and even larger towns like Tucson, Arizona, for example, claiming that they had their largest peace rally in their history recently with about 1,500 people showing up. So what we're seeing is large numbers of people turning out for anti-war demonstrations in locations all across the country that in some places are record numbers.
Would it be fair to say there are these movements in every state in the country?
Pretty much every state. We've been picking up new members. We've got membership in 41 states right now, you know, and I'm confident that we'll be seeing all 50 at some point. So, yeah, I think it's nationwide.
And when you say you have members in 41 states, how many people do you think that represents?
That's really hard to say because the network is a network of groups, not individuals. So groups can range in size from, a handful of people to, large organizations. And again, it's, do you count the people who are active or do you count the people on the lists and databases? Some groups have, several thousand people on their database. Some people have, 50 to 100. It's very hard to get a clear picture of what kind of numbers we're talking about.
And who are the people? Are we talking about people that have been traditionally anti-war, the pacifists, those on the left of the political spectrum for most of their lives? Or are there people that might be considered in the center or even to the right that are opposing this war?
Well, I certainly think that concern about this war is moving into the center. I don't think it's just traditional left, particularly young people now. We're starting at this point, a little bit lagging behind, but we're starting to see high school students and college students get organized and start to plan protests and so forth. Faith groups and churches have always been pretty strong voices in the anti-sanctions movement, but we've seen in the last month or so some particularly strong statements from religious leaders and also a larger number of those statements.
We conducted actually a series on our program, Peace Watch, where we talked to a number of religious leaders and spiritual leaders basically across the spectrum. And we found that wholesale, with perhaps one exception, with an individual that was representing the White House, everyone felt as though this was an unjust war. What kind of feedback have you gotten, or have you been able to gauge or calculate in any way the religious and spiritual community?
That, I think, is hard to say. I think, by and large, my interaction with the religious and spiritual community has been very positive and that there's a strong sentiment that they really aren't convinced that this is a just war. I certainly am hearing from people on the right who email and call and occasionally and express their strong opinions, in favor of the war and so forth. But usually it's not with a religious slant on it. I think that, one of the problems we're having is the message. I think the left is a little bit, the anti-war movement is a little bit foggy on its message and needs to work on that and needs to be engaging more with the public debate that we see in the corporate and the mainstream media.
What debate is that?
It's a controlled debate. It's a debate between kind of like, should we go in today or should we go in tomorrow? Should we wait for inspectors or should we not? And there's not much of a voice given to people who are against the war, virtually none, you could say. When they are on, it's very marginalized. And I think that's a huge problem, and it's not necessarily the fault of the left, but it would be beneficial if we had widely recognized big-name individuals taking stronger statements against this war.
And so what about once you leave the borders of the United States, Canada and in Europe? What kind of a scope do you see there? What's the breadth of the anti-war movement globally?
Well, I think it's taking off, and I'm a little bit concerned that there's some kind of overlap. I do think that the issue, the Iraq issue, is a complicated issue, and it's hard for people to just make, you know, one stand and then stick to that. But, of course, there is a group called Al-Qaeda out there that's operating.
And you have September 11th, which the administration has done a fairly successful job of tying them together.
Right. And you know, a lot of people in the mainstream are not paying careful attention to the way the administration is manipulating the facts about Iraq and trying to link it with Al-Qaeda when it has no evidence, really. But I'm personally very concerned about Al-Qaeda. I personally expect that we're going to see some attacks here in the U.S. by Al-Qaeda, particularly if the United States invades Iraq. I think that Al-Qaeda may, then see that this is their chance to retaliate, and that concerns me greatly. I also think that the Muslim community internationally is a little bit mixed on this. I think there's a degree of support or sympathy for Al-Qaeda because here's a group that stood up to Uncle Sam, you know, when a lot of Arab leaders are caving into supporting a U.S. attack against an Arab regime. It's very kind of a difficult sea out there to try and understand what's happening within the Muslim community.
So if you had to just sort of articulate what the anti-war movement looks like at this point in this country, how many people would you say are involved, or how many groups? Is the older generation involved, or is this mostly high school and college students, as you said earlier?
Oh, I think it's the older generation leading the way so far. I don't think high school students and college students have been in the leadership, but I see that as an emerging factor. I think faith groups have been very steady, and I think the real heart and soul of the peace movement is grassroots groups in, you know, localities everywhere. And really, you know, for the longest time, you've had the small group of core individuals in your local community, you know, shouldering, you know, the burden. But gradually, while the movement at large is growing very rapidly, I think gradually those grassroots groups is growing right now. But I don't want to be too optimistic because I know how difficult of a time it is to be a grassroots activist and how you don't want to have, you know, over-optimistic expectations about how much support you have, because sometimes, you know, you always feel like it's the same few individuals carrying the burden in a particular locality.
Now, we know that hundreds of thousands showed up at the October 26th peace rally here in Washington. Do you have figures from other cities as well? And is there a way to calculate, add those up, get to a sum total?
I think when you look at the vote in Congress and you look at how Congress responded to the tens and hundreds, maybe of thousands of phone calls that came into their offices, I think we're talking millions of people. I think really we're talking about a public that's a little bit confused on the issue, but really it's fairly divided one way and the other, with a lot of people sort of sitting on the fence, not really knowing which way to turn, which way to fall on this issue. So I really think the peace movement has much broader support than what we're seeing in the media, and we're talking about, you know, a broad cross-section of the American public. So tens, hundreds of millions of people. How many people are active? I think that's a much smaller figure.
Mike Zamolek is Outreach Coordinator for the National Network to End the War Against Iraq. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.